Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
I'm trying to adjust my headphones.
Hey, here. Pete.
Hey, how's it going?
Pete, is there life on Mars?
No, but when we interviewed James Ray, who was part of the team with NASA that discovered water.
We didn't interview anybody. What are you talking about?
I did. I did. I don't know where you were. On Inside the Black Box yesterday.
Are you all right? Are you dying? Tell me you're dying.
No, I'm not dying. I'm just...
What's wrong with you? Oh, you ate
I'm reacting
right
to
before
breakfast.
You came in, didn't you?
I always do.
Don't you know
breakfast
that
is the most important meal of the day?
Breakfast is awful for you. No, but preparing for the podcast by consuming a big chunk of whatever, that's not how you do it.
You made it sound like I just found a random
piece of
roadkill
and
hacked
right
off.
I am lean and mean and unfed. I got 3 cups of coffee in me, and I'm hangry.
Okay, what does hangry mean?
I don't know. It's something the kids are saying these days. It's when you get angry because you're hungry.
Oh, hangry. I like that.
Yeah. So yeah, I will paint the walls of the studio with you if I have to. I just want you to know that.
Again, threats of physical violence.
You're all slowed down by your biscuit and
I have some iced tea here.
Tea combo? Yeah, exactly. So you'd stand no chance against me, old man.
I mean, what is this, a contest? Is this the Colosseum?
Was that you?
Ancient Rome?
Was that me?
No, that was some device that you have shoved on your pants going bing.
It's in my other pants, I thought. This chair is talking to me. Did you hear that?
Okay.
Life on Mars. So the water on Mars is a big deal. And not only is it a big deal like as a discovery, but it's also a big deal as the giant narrative of science in America. I can't speak internationally because I'm just some schmo, but I have noticed that...
I think it's international. I think we're all excited about it.
I believe that, but yeah. I just can't speak to that because I don't read Le Monde. And I don't check out BBC.
You don't read Der Spiegel.
I definitely not. But yeah, it's a what do you call it? It's a lightning rod, is what it is, and a Rorschach blot at the same time.
All right, you're gonna have to explain that one. How is a scientific discovery about? And it's not just water on Mars. There's been water on Mars for a while, but liquid flowing water.
Oh, the flowing water is the big deal?
Yeah.
I thought that we thought there was water on Mars, and then we decided there wasn't water on Mars, and then there was ice, and then there were canals, and then there were
so we've
aliens,
gone back and forth.
And then there weren't aliens, and then... I might have gotten the timeline a little mixed up there.
I don't know. I guess I'm still reeling from the fact that regardless of what we think about water on Mars and what our motivations are to study that sort of thing, Rush Limbaugh has claimed...
This is my lightning rod thing, right? It is drawing to it heat and light from commentators and just regular folks who maybe don't have... It's like when chocolate is subject to some kind of scientific study.
Really? That's a lightning rod?
Yeah, because suddenly people pay attention to it who maybe would not have paid attention to...
Because it's chocolate.
Because it's chocolate.
Is it just because we like chocolate?
I think so. Recently, I mean in the last few years, someone created an artificially bad study about chocolate. They got like 11 subjects and did a 3-week trial with a control group of a low-carb diet and a low-carb diet with chocolate. And they did these incredible, like, variegated data sets, you know, sort of like, how are you sleeping? Did you lose any weight? How's your mood? You know, do you like the sunshine?
But it was deliberately faked.
Yeah, they did all
and
this
what was
stuff.
The conclusion?
Well, wait. They did all this stuff to get enough data that they could fudge. That's not a pun. And to have all of these, like, little Easter eggs of, this is a crappy study. You know, too few people, too
right.
short.
Yeah.
Too sort of about what they were actually studying.
I'm not sure there's a statistical metric for it.
So they found that the people who ate chocolate, they had like a pound or two less. They lost a few extra pounds, and they slept better.
Okay. You know, so the conclusion, chocolate is good.
Chocolate will help you lose weight, and it'll help you sleep better. That was like the thing.
Yeah.
And then they did press releases, right, that were... full of stuff about the study,
right?
You know, but not that it was too small, not that it was statistically insignificant.
Right. Many studies are
with made up quotes.
And did they do this purposely to deceive or just to get people's reaction?
To deceive, but then to see what that deception wrought.
Okay, so later they reported the deception as part of a psychological experiment.
It's all part of, I don't know if it's part of an experiment. Here's the thing. They faked an experiment. Possibly
Who are these people? Are these legitimate researchers?
Yes.
Who vetted their protocol through an institute review board,
no.
human subjects?
No, no.
Are these guys just from The Onion?
No, they are people who care about real scientific studies. They are people who think that you should vet studies, that journalists should be skeptical and all that. But what they did was they built up an artifice, mm-hmm. right? It's about chocolate. It's got too small a study size. It has a few sort of, yay, you can eat chocolate and lose weight. You know, you can sleep better kind of conclusions. It has made up quotes that people weren't going to fact check, they assumed.
Right.
And they sent it out into the world. And also they made a point to try to sell it. They tried to do pay-for-play coverage on certain newspapers. And so then that is essentially a case study of here's how bad science gets picked up and turned into
something. So their intentions were good. Their intentions were to illustrate and study bad science.
I don't know if their intentions were good, Pete. They did lie.
Are you going to tell me who these guys
were? They lied. They cheated.
Are these
people
from a university? Are they from a government lab?
I don't think it was from a government lab.
Are they friends of yours?
They are not friends of mine.
Sell knockoff handbags out of their
trunk? I've never even met these assholes. I will look it up. See, here's the thing, Pete. You know that I didn't prepare anything. I was just talking, and then you gotta go, yeah,
this is rather fascinating, though.
Well, let me eat chocolate study. Doctor? I don't know. Well, we'll just do this. I am searching on the media chocolate study because I heard about there we go. Trickster journalist explains why he duped the media.
Oh, so it's a journalist.
John Bohannon. Ah, okay, cool. This was a journalist who faked a scientific study and now is reporting on the elaborate hoax that he created.
Okay, but journalist or not, he was trying to do an experiment.
He's a science... Here's where my memory mistake came in. He's a science journalist.
Okay.
And so this was about how journalists consume press releases and science and popular narratives.
Right.
His name was John Bohannon, Bohannon.
We'll give you a cell phone number later.
If you search for journalist scammed the media, you should be able to find it. I fooled millions into thinking chocolate helps weight loss. That was a thing he did. Mm-hmm. And so that is a lightning rod. And I'm just using this phrase. This is not, there might be a way people use lightning rod to describe this kind of stuff that's different. I'm just saying that when you say chocolate does this good thing, it draws attention. It draws people to it. And they're unskeptical in a lot of ways because you want it to be true. You want to say,
I think this is an example of
everybody, chocolate is good for you. That sort of thing.
I think this is something we've recently talked about in a class we have here at Georgia Tech called Startup Lab.
That's a class.
I'm sitting in with it. And it's an excellent class. It talks about, you know, sort of systematic methods to evaluate customer viewpoint via customer discovery. And their thesis is that you should talk to customers directly, that you shouldn't do surveys online, you shouldn't do paper surveys, because you get more interesting information about actually dealing with the person. And
now, this is tangential. But isn't getting those aggregates... mm-hmm. easier than trying to build focus group? Like, yeah, talk to your customers directly, but you can't talk to 10,000 people, whereas there's...
Yeah, it's easier to get more people, but their thesis is it's better to talk to 10 or 50 or 100 people than get 10,000 people doing a survey.
Huh, okay.
Because you don't know the answer. It's very important because you say, look, we're wondering, would you use this kind of a product to accomplish this?
Yeah.
And what's nice is people will do exactly what you did. They will go off on a tangent and say, no, actually, that's not the important part.
So it's interviews rather than surveys.
Yeah, it's interviews.
They want
that's the point they make.
Information. They want to be able to kind of dig into what's going on.
And this is a lost art among students. The best example I can think of is in a book that was written about you know, over legalization of issues in America, where two guys were talking about a plane.
Did you just say over legalization?
Yeah, I know that's not a word. I can't remember the name of the book.
Weren't you complaining about people making up words?
I was. And I was complaining about Kevin McCarthy saying untrustable.
Whoa. I brought that up casually for the joke, but we are not talking politics today.
No, we're not talking politics, but that's what got me angry. That and the parking ticket I got last night. So I may not have as much caffeine as you, but I've got anger on my side. The point is, we talked last week.
That's right. When Pete is angry.
We talked about cognitive bias. And the problem when you try to talk to people directly.
Is that the science name for prejudiced?
No. It is, in a sense, prejudice.
I know that word has like a racial tinge to it, right. You know, because people usually think of it, but you could be prejudiced about anything almost.
The placebo effect is a good example of a cognitive bias.
Cognitive bias.
That you feel if you are actively doing something to alleviate your symptoms, it's likely going to work. That's a classic cognitive bias.
Magic works, Pete.
But what sometimes appears to be magic is purely a cognitive bias. I learned about a new cognitive bias when my colleague, Dr. Siva Kumar from the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department, was talking about this. He gave a great talk, and he listed about 120 or more standard cognitive biases, and one of the ones he listed was called the IKEA bias or the IKEA effect. And I'm just like, okay.
IKEA, the furniture retailer?
Yeah, I had to look this up. So he's given the talk. I looked this up. Apparently, this was a study done at Harvard. I don't know how well it was done because I didn't have a chance to read the details.
Hey, look, I've been on the Harvard campus. Those people are idiots.
Wait, just because you've been on the Harvard campus? Wow. Why such vitriol toward folks at Harvard?
It was a joke I really used to enjoy, and this was years ago, but I was, you know, I had friends at Harvard, and I went, and it was just, you know, it was just regular. You know, the facilities were a little bit better than I was used to at Georgia Tech, but, you know, I didn't go to Harvard and feel like, wow, these are the best and the brightest students, you know?
Oh, no, they have some idiots there, too.
Absolutely.
They have some really bright folks.
And that's what I'm going with, really.
So you went to Harvard.
No, I didn't go to Harvard.
You went to Harvard. You visited Harvard.
I visited
to
Harvard.
To live deliberately.
Actually, I visited Harvard to score. So,
how old were you?
I was young.
That's a common theme among young people. My headphones are cutting out on me again.
Well, you shouldn't
touch
them.
What is this? What is this duct tape on the headphones?
It's wrapped in brown tape that they use
some
to
kind of packing
signify
tape.
The weekend CDs.
But the IKEA cognitive bias basically concluded that if you build it with your own two hands, you suddenly have more faith in it. I would think it would be the opposite among most people.
Yeah, but see, so the problem there is that, yes, that's probably true.
Right.
Except IKEA, you don't build it with your own hands. You assemble it with your own hands.
I think it is the assembly thing.
Do you want to take 30 seconds out of the podcast and replace your headphones with those headphones that do not have tape on them?
Indeed.
Go for it. So the lightning rod thing that I'm talking about with the water on Mars is that it's not, I don't know if sexy is the word for it, because sexy is overused as a way to describe information or ideas, but flowing water on Mars is so built up through our history of you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs and Martians and, you know, and
Stranger in a Strange Land.
I would actually believe more. Just let me slide a little bit into my own conspiracy theories. I would believe it a little more that the studio that's putting out The Martian called up NASA and said, "You got anything on Mars that you can push real hard right now?"
It was just fortuitous that these guys had.
I would believe
that
more than I believe that NASA has been falsifying data and has made up a story. But it turns out Rush Limbaugh still has a show, and people have not stopped listening to him and pulled all the advertising.
He has a multi-million-dollar deal through 2016.
Despite the fact that he has said this now, right? So some people just heard that and went, "Oh yeah, it's Rush."
But other people believe him.
The person on your show on Inside the Black Box, noon on Wednesdays on 91.1.
Dr. James Ray from the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences.
Dr. James Ray was like, "Well, maybe he's just trying to be skeptical." And I'll tell you something. I know a number of skeptics who actually are self-identified skeptics. And
yeah.
I like them.
Skepticism is a good thing.
But it does seem that, like libertarianism, skepticism can sometimes just be a way to codify being an asshole.
Yeah, sometimes. Absolutely. I attended the Skeptics track at Dragon Con for the second year in a row. And most folks there are very skeptical about these cognitive biases.
Like a Deleuzian field of anuses.
But some people are just jerkwads. But what's interesting is not only did James Ray, he read the book like I did, he got an advanced screening of the movie.
Nice.
And he said it's very good. I'm paraphrasing by saying who's the guy that starred in it?
Your wife wants to nail him.
I don't know. I mean,
Matt Damon.
She finds him attractive. I don't think I would say it like my wife wants to nail him.
Come on, that's Pete. What does the phrase "I find them attractive" really mean?
Yeah, but that hurts me.
I wasn't even trying. That was great. Okay.
Right, so you wounded me without even trying. Good for you. He's like basically Matt Damon, what an actor. So he said Matt Damon did a good job. And actually we did concur that the science was basically accurate.
Well, that's
so
the point.
That's the neat part about the movie. So right? As an engineer, I'm looking forward to it and I enjoyed the book because of that. The science, by the way, and here's an interesting thing. So we think about society and the way we do things differently now than we did in the past, and the idea of crowdsourcing. Right? We crowdsource a lot. We crowdsource funding, for example, now. That's a new thing. I think that's kind of cool. I think that's really good. Works specifically for the arts. People try to do it for science. Doesn't work quite as well.
Now, why are you laughing?
Because it doesn't work quite as well for science.
But what about that is, why is that funny? And I'm asking. I'm not attacking.
Just because, you know, that's what I do. I mean, I solicit funding for science and applied science. And crowdsourcing works better for the arts.
Because there's less money involved?
Part of it might be less money, but part of it is because the arts are more relatable.
That emotional investment, yeah.
Right. And we'll talk about my theory as to why science isn't quite as relatable in just a moment.
Here are my pennies and here are my good vibes.
He crowdsourced the book and the technology in the book. I found this out from Steve Fleming, who is the director of the Enterprise Innovation Institute here at Georgia Tech, and also basically one of the founders of a space exploration company, X-Core, I believe it's called. He was giving a panel at DragonCon on space exploration. And he, by the way, will be interviewing, and this podcast will probably go out after
this will be next
Atlanta
Wednesday.
Maker Fair. But if you did attend the Atlanta
weekend.
Maker Fair, Steve...
So just to orient everyone in time, today is the 1st of October.
And this weekend...
But this podcast won't be released until the 8th of October.
Right. And the 3rd and the 4th will be Maker Faire Atlanta in downtown
Maybe the
7th Decatur.
Of October.
On Sunday at noon, they will be interviewing... what's his name? It'll come to me.
Yeah.
The author of the book,
Pete's
The Martian.
Making motions. Andy Weir?
Andy Weir. And Steve is going to be
What day is next Wednesday?
I don't know. 7th?
Okay. 7th. This... podcast is actually on October 7th, despite the fact that we're recording on October 1st.
Okay. And you're messing with me
travel?
Here. Now I don't even remember the point I was trying to make.
You read the book.
Crowdsourcing. You're
talking about emotional
investment.
Oh, yeah.
No, and I thought that was neat that he crowdsourced the technology. He wrote it in bits and pieces and posted it on the internet, and then people commented.
Because he self-published, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. They commented about the technology. That's why the technology is so well done. It was a group effort. It was crowdsourced. I think that's an excellent way to write a science fiction book. To me, that's new.
I still love the XCKD or XKCD. It doesn't matter.
I think it is XKCD.
Who cares? He's got both spellings.
Oh, does he really?
I websites, didn't realize that. Yeah. But the cartoon about the Martian that has just the perfect phrase, I think, to describe it. And any minute now, it'll come up. Here we go. You know the scene in Apollo 13 where the guy says, "We have to figure out how to connect this thing to this thing using this table full of parts, or the astronauts will all die?" Yeah. The Martian is for people who wish the whole movie had been more of that scene.
That is eerily accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and
I like that scene though.
Well, I think it's a really compelling, it's a compelling narrative just in the sense of, look, you know, save yourself. Right. But it's also, it's very compelling when something is real. That's just, you know, that's, that's like base level.
And it was
humanity,
quite realistic. Right. Right. So he got a little luck in there, but there were also some catastrophic failures that might be representative.
You know why Breaking Bad was so popular?
No.
I don't either. But I know that one reason.
What the hell good are you?
That Breaking Bad,
I'm
going to
make
really
some
popular
up now. I really don't know if it's true or not.
No, no. One reason that it was. Like, Breaking Bad was one of those everything hit right kind of shows. You know, like a good actor. A good actor can play a part, right? But a great actor for a part embodies it, you know? Mm-hmm. And the team trusted each other, all that stuff. But one of the things about Breaking Bad was that they made you believe that the things that were happening were accurately portrayed and that were conceivable.
Yeah.
You know, right down to things like, and seriously, spoiler alert, but what are you doing? If you want to watch Breaking Bad, you should have already done it. Scenes where meth is made,
right,
looked accurate, made the viewer feel like they were actually seeing how it was done. The way someone prepared to murder someone was not like a surprise, you know, someone steps out from behind the shadows and shoots somebody. But, you know, there was even a conversation, maybe a third episode, where Walter says to Jesse, how are you going to shoot him? And Jesse says, I'm just going to walk up and him, pow. He's like, no, no. Tell me how you're going to do this. Here's the gun. Tell me how you're going to take this gun and shoot him. It's like, I'm going to pick it. He's like, do you know, are there bullets in there? How does the gun work? Like, he almost gave a manifesto for how the show was going to treat these things.
Well, to me, it was very realistic because I know the type Walter White. They don't go fully into his background, but he appears to be a Caltech-trained organic chemist.
Have you watched the whole thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, organic chemists like that and scientists, they think about these things.
Yeah.
So to be honest, someone that well-trained in organic chemistry could do very good things with drug synthesis and separation and purification and things like that. It is something that most organic chemists think about. And this is why I cannot stand conservative politicians.
No,
who
stop.
Look at,
no,
who,
no.
I can't.
No.
Not let me bring.
Look, all I'm asking is that instead of going to the, I can't stand these people that I am opposed to politically, just talk about what they're doing.
Okay.
You can't stand what happens.
And that is the criticism of young urban kids who turn to selling drugs. Because if, you know, so I grew up in the suburbs where I had opportunities for summer jobs.
Right.
I mean, I had a job as the lab aide for the science department. It was both educational, good experience, and I made a little money. It was a great thing. But if you are in an urban environment where the schools maybe don't get the funding they need and you worry about getting shot going home to do your homework, you would do the math. If you were a smart kid and you would say, hey, selling drugs is much more lucrative. It's probably worth the risk. That's what I'm going to do. And to be honest, graduate students in organic chemistry all across this country do that same calculation.
Like, should I make some drugs to pay, be able to pay my
rent?
And
the point is, they say, well, look, you know, I'm going to get a graduate degree. I'll get a job working for a chemical company. I'm going to do okay. I have possibilities. But then they look at the money they could make by synthesizing crystal meth or ecstasy or something like that. And they're tempted, and probably every year, one or two folks, these are only the ones that are caught, do a little synthesis, yada, yada, yada.
Let me roll back a little bit before we get to your actual confession of how you were. What would be the Heisenberg equivalent for your field?
Oh, so what do you mean by the Heisenberg?
So Walter White uses Heisenberg as one of his pseudonyms.
Right, Werner Heisenberg of the Heisenberg Uncertainty Principle.
Right. But you're an engineer. What would be your?
So for chemists, you know, it'd be Heisenberg. It'd be, you know, maybe Linus Pauling, folks like that.
Ah, so you would be Pauling.
Pauling might be good because as a chemical engineer, Pauling's undergraduate degree, I believe, was in chemical engineering. Oh, so what nickname? Okay, yeah. This is like the debate question where they ask, what would your Secret Service handle be?
I'm saying you're about to confess to your drug kingpin-ness.
No, no, right? I've never synthesized drugs.
You didn't have a brother in the DEA, so you got away with it.
I've never synthesized drugs.
Okay, so listen.
Nor would I, but I understand why people do that math and come to that conclusion.
There is a way that people can enjoy the story, say, of science, mm-hmm. because they have some connection to it. They understand what, like with the Martian. I think that engineers and engineer-minded people mm-hmm. are going to have a deeper appreciation of it because of their joy at it being correct, uh-huh. right? And I'm sure that the story itself is compelling to everybody because, you know, save your own self, right? Save your lives. Right. And I do like how everyone's like, Matt Damon is the Martian, but then, you know, you look at the production stills, there's like five people in the team up there. There's more than Matt Damon up there.
Well, but only at the beginning and the end.
Oh, wow.
I don't think I'm giving anything up. He's stranded on Mars alone.
You're giving a little bit
it's
up.
It's in the trailer.
Okay.
Bite me.
Right, right. But then when Mars...
Well, the team on Earth, NASA...
Stop
really
talking.
Big team.
Mars has water. Mars has flowing water. What is the way that someone can connect to accuracy? What's the way that someone can connect to what that means? I am not in any way schooled on other planets, right?
Okay.
On what it means that there's water on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can make stuff up because it's fun to make stuff up, but like I don't have it. I do know that that's less important to my immediate cosmological understanding of the world
okay.
than I think some people do. Some people are ready for Mars to have life now. They're ready for it to
right.
be, you know, oh, when the asteroid that had the microbes that came to Earth, when it hit Earth, it also bounced off and it landed on Mars. And so there's probably some microbes in the water there, and Mars in, a billion years will be Earth. You know, like you can make
yeah,
a story
Mars is not
going to
be Earth in a billion years.
Right.
Mars may have been very different a billion years before. And we did learn some very interesting things. And this is the reward of science. This is what people sometimes miss is you go out looking for something and you find things you never bet on. So I think it's fundamental for us to see, is life unique to here or can it exist other places? And just to find the building blocks, the things that might make life possible, like water, which in our understanding of life is very, very important. You know, we're worried about, I think it's moons of Jupiter, may have water on it and may have stuff growing underneath.
One of those
aspects.
Moons, yeah, has a sheet of ice around it that could actually be.
Yeah, that's actually probably more likely. But we're studying Mars because, I mean, this is why Magellan and Cook, they sailed the oceans and they explored.
Oh,
these are modern
are we
explorers.
Are exploit the Martians and give them diseases?
No,
they can't
we're not.
And
here's why. I learned two interesting things. There is a prime directive. I didn't know this.
What?
There's a treaty that's been signed. And okay, nobody really cares. It's not like it was signed by governments. It was probably signed by the equivalent of NASA and the European Space Agency at different places. And I forget the name of it, but James Ray talked about this. It's this sort of non-contamination treaty.
Nice.
The reason they are not, there are no immediate plans to take any one of our rovers or a future rover and send it to these streaks of water is we have a rule, and the rule is nothing that hasn't been steam sterilized in an autoclave, so high temperature sterilized, can touch water or any place where we think there may be life. Why? Because we're afraid we're going to contaminate it.
Right, right.
And
right.
That's horrible for the experiments because you go in and say, oh, I mean, okay, this is like crime scene investigator CSI.
Why?
No, it's a great show. I love it. But, I mean, they have these people walking around, I mean, just, you know, fondling the crime scene and things like that.
Right,
they don't
right.
always do the right technique. But in any case, they don't want us to come, you know, then come back in 10 years and realize this colony of bacteria was growing, but we contaminated it.
Right. We brought that there.
So I asked them, I said, this is like the prime directive of Star Trek, where you're not allowed to interfere with other civilizations, except unlike Star Trek, they're actually doing it correctly. Whereas, you know, Captain Kirk would land there, you know, go on a date with a green alien and say, well, we didn't mess him up too bad. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting that they would do that. So they've got to think of a different way to go there. And whatever they touch this water with, They have to make sure that it's been sterilized so we have no cross-contamination. The second thing we learned is about cross-contamination. We share rocks with Mars. So a popular theory that they think they have evidence for is that, you know, whether it's asteroids or things, you know, whacking into each other and bouncing off Mars and bouncing off the Earth. And this is over billions of years.
Is that a technical term?
It's much like pinball. It's the pinball theory. That's what I'm calling it. So rocks have gone back and forth, you know, in small amounts. So the question is, did they seed us? Did we seed them? What's going on? It's like the movie Mission to Mars.
Yeah, which was terrible.
I love that movie. Why did you hate that movie? This is about the face on Mars.
It's very clunky. In the its craft was poor.
Oh, the movie.
Yeah.
Right, but the idea of the science is not that much different than the science in The Martian, a self-sustainable habitat. What Mark, the name of the astronaut that's played by Matt Damon, did was not all that, you know, different than the way they did the habitat. Habitat in The Martian was flexible. It's like a tent.
Stop. So we're going to have to watch The Martian.
Okay.
And probably Mission to Mars.
Yeah, and it will come out. Have you watched Mission to Mars?
I mean, a long time ago, but I have to watch it again.
I like Mission to Mars. Yeah, and I'm willing to admit the cinematography might have been substandard.
You know what else you like.
And that would be...
This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can't you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.